Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
At some point in our life, we learn to appreciate the finer things. Small batch, top shelf, handcrafted, American made. Something you can touch, smell, and feel. The kind of experience you won't get with the click of a mouse or a swipe of your touchscreen. It's real. It's Jacques. Jacques is America's only luxury nudie magazine for those of us who know the good old days are happening here and now. A full-featured erotic magazine boasting full-page nude pictorials of real, beautiful women in America today were never retouched, and unlike anything you've experienced before, framed with edgy editorial, outspoken opinion, and effortless class. Jacques is the magazine your father kept hidden under his mattress, but you display proudly on your coffee table. Appreciate the finer things. Discover Jacques. The world will never be the same again. Visit jacques-mag.com.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I'm very excited to talk to our next guest. She's an author who writes about a group of people who we don't hear nearly enough about. Welcome, Ruth Madison. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm doing great. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
So you are a writer, and you are. I'm just going to take the intro that I know about you, which is that after years of combing through the dusty back shelves of libraries looking for your elusive, imperfect hero, you started writing your own fiction. So what were you looking for?
I was looking for love stories that featured men who had physical disabilities. So that was a pretty difficult thing to find. I mean, it still is, but the internet has made it easier to find that sort of thing. But yeah, I would have all these like little tricks and secrets to try to locate books that had that theme to them, because it was often something that was kind of hidden.
So what kind of tricks did you have? Like, how was there like some sort of keyword? Like, were there places that you knew that were more likely to have stuff? What were you doing up until you started writing your own stuff?
Yeah, there were like, I can't even remember now because it was so long ago. It was like 20 years ago, but, just certain words in titles that would make you think, oh, this is inspirational. That probably means that it's going to have a disability in it and things like that. And just getting really attuned to looking at covers and seeing like, oh, this person looks shorter than the other person. I wonder if they're trying to say they're in a wheelchair without actually showing it.
Why do you think that it is so difficult to find?
Well, it's unclear how many people are really attracted to disability, or wounded heroes, which is kind of one way of expressing that interest. But I think there's some variety there with people who are just interested in kind of seeing somebody vulnerable overcome something difficult versus people who have a real fetish for it. So both of those groups, the number of people that have that is probably pretty slim. There's not a huge market for it.
So one of the things that I was going to ask you about, and you sort of touched on already, is this concept of there being like two different means through which people get to like tend to be grouped into this. So I've talked to a few different folks with disabilities who've had, again, this very bifurcated idea, some of whom are like, so being attracted to people with disabilities is not a paraphilia, and to say so is incredibly insulting to people with disabilities. And then other folks I've talked to have said there's a degree of, you know, fetishizing my disability makes me feel like an object, and that they're not into me, they're into this like thing about me. Is that remotely like what you were talking about? Do you find those descriptions to be like in your own experience?
I would say that the fetishizing, objectifying thing is kind of a misunderstanding. I have yet to ever meet someone with this attraction who is only interested and fixated on that one aspect.
Okay.
I mean, over and over again, they'll tell you like, well, the whole person really matters, but this is what physically turns me on. And then of course you need to have other aspects if you're going to have a relationship. And I think it's the same thing that you see in any kind of physical attraction, because you're initially going to be drawn to somebody for, you know, they have beautiful eyes, they have great abs, there's something that makes you interested, and then you get to know them. And for people like us, it's, wow, they have really hot paralyzed legs or stumps or something that feels weird to the rest of society. But to us, it's just like, wow, that's so beautiful. This person's really hot. I need to get to know them better.
So you would compare it to like preference for redheads or like liking beards or just like any other like inexplicable physical attraction?
Kind of.
Okay.
I do say that it's a fetish. And when I say that, I don't mean the way that you described it with the fixating on this one aspect, but okay. More like it's a necessary part of the whole package.
Okay.
Like, I cannot have satisfying sex without disability being present in some way.
Okay.
So because it's impossible for it not to be part of my sex life, I see that as being a fetish. But I also think that the word fetish has some unfounded negative connotations, and that people with all kinds of fetishes have the same kind of like, I don't like to be talked about like that. And, you know, it's minimizing my experiences and that kind of thing.
So in your personal experience in describing that you want disability to be present in order for a sexual experience to happen, what kind of disability? Are you more interested in some than others? Like what would you prefer? What is good enough? What is like not adequate?
So when I was a teenager and just kind of being super hormonal and having these fantasies about this ideal man, to me, it started out with paraplegia. I was really attracted to paraplegics. The real strong difference between the very built upper body and the very weak lower body. But then when I got into my mid-20s and I started actually dating, I've dated a wide variety of men with really varied disabilities. And I found that my standards were much looser than I thought. It was really easy to find what was attractive about each one of them.
So what for you else is good other than paraplegia? Like, are there other things that you've expanded to be like interested in, or people you've dated and then you became more interested in that particular disability?
Yeah. I would say, I like amputation, quadriplegia, cerebral palsy. And a lot of that was because of dating people. I, you know, had the experience and tried it out and liked it, and that expanded my horizons, I guess.
So when you're dating, how do you explain this to the folks you're dating, and how do they usually like, what's that conversation look like?
It's really important to me to be very upfront with it immediately. I met most of these men on a dating site specifically for people with disabilities. So naturally, one of the first questions is, you don't have a disability. Why are you here? And so I would tell them immediately that it's because I'm a devotee, and, you know, give them the opportunity to ask any questions about what that means, to explain any misconceptions they might have about it, and to kind of allay their fears. I do think it's easier for me as a woman, because my experience has been that men are less afraid of being objectified. Mm. Women have like much more of a history of needing to be afraid of men who are more powerful than they are, or who look at them as objects instead of human. So men were less threatened by me than I think disabled females with male devs are.
Can you describe the term devotee for somebody who might not be familiar?
Yeah, it's a really dumb word, but we don't have a better one. Somebody came up with this, I guess, because it rhymed. But a while back, probably 50 or 70 years ago, people thought that amputation was the only attraction for people like me. And so they coined this phrase, amputee devotee, because it just has such a ring to it. And I guess because they saw us as sort of like, you know, mindlessly worshiping people with amputation, which is also not really true. But it just kind of stuck. There's been some other words for it. Admirer is a word that used to get used. But I have just shortened it to dev. And I figure we kind of have to work with what we've got, what people have heard before.
So other than disability, what are other things just like personality traits? Like, who are you into? What are you about? Like, who is your ideal man?
It certainly took a lot of soul searching to figure that out. And I think, again, this is true of people with any kind of attraction, that you can get kind of distracted by how attractive somebody is and not pay attention to the other aspects because you're so blinded by how hot they are that you just don't want to acknowledge it. So
I'm well familiar.
So I dated people with a lot of different kinds of personalities, and I really tried to make things work past the point where they shouldn't, you know, push them further than they should have gone many a time. I dated a lot of really like macho guys, something to prove. And in the end, I found that I really prefer quiet, geeky, secure men who are confident in who they are and don't need to prove something.
Do you think that there's a difference between folks who have had a disability their whole lives and those who acquired one later in terms of those kind of personality things?
Yes, I absolutely do. I think there's a lot of problems with the way that society views disability, and we haven't come close to beginning to address those. And so the trouble from my point of view is that people spend their whole lives with this perception of disability as this scary other thing that is, you know, ruins your life and makes you useless or something like that. And then they become disabled and they still have all of that baggage of what that means. And it's just really difficult to fight through that and get to a secure place. And so I always feel like if we had a better understanding of disability for all of us from the beginning, that transition would not be so brutal. That if we realize that people with disabilities are just like anybody else and can accomplish anything that anyone else can, it would just make it so much easier.
So you started writing your own fiction. And is it like just stories? Is it romantic fiction? Is it like sexy fiction? Like what do you like to write about?
It's, to me, it's sexy, but it doesn't actually have a whole lot of sex in it. I like focusing on those little romantic moments, like noticing this really sexy trait in someone and zooming in on it. So my books are full of those kind of little moments for people like me. But I started out writing the first book that I wrote, and the one that's been the most successful is called Whole. And it's about the experience of being a devotee. And I felt like I had to write that first before I could write any other kind of romantic fiction, because otherwise people would notice that all of my books, all of my stories have disabled male characters, and they would, you know, whisper about me or, you know, figure out this secret. I felt like I had to go on the offensive and say, yes, this is something that I have, and I'm explaining it here, so now we can all move past it and I can start writing these romantic stories.
So it was sort of like a coming out story for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
What was it and like putting you know, paper to pen and like really talking about the core of like your attraction and who you are? And this is like an identity piece, and this is about your sexual interest, which is not a thing that everybody necessarily tells the world.
Yeah, so my mother says. It was really hard. I was determined that I wasn't going to go easy on myself, that I had to find the dark places and keep on digging and digging. So it took me about 10 years to write the book and to get it finished. And it was really difficult. And then, you know, you publish it and you put it out there for the world and your whole soul is exposed for anybody to judge and comment on. And it's been interesting to look at the kind of comments that I get about my main character, Elizabeth, who is completely based on me and who I was at that age, not who I am anymore, really. But, you know, some people really relate to her and others say she's creepy or she's antisocial or some other thing about her.
Did you get feedback from people who were like, yes, this is my experience too? Like, I feel this. Did you get any of that?
I did. It was so validating because I had no interaction with other people like me before I wrote it. And so, you know, the internet was still kind of a new thing. I'm making myself sound so old. I'm 33. So this was like the late 90s and people were using the internet, but not as much, I guess, as now. And,
oh, that's a real thing. I remember that. Like, if you didn't log into your Hotmail address within 30 days, you just like lost it. I remember that. I remember these days. Life was rough.
The internet was not on my radar. You know, my dad had told me it's a good place to do research for school papers. It was not interesting to me. So that was when I started writing the book. And then, of course, 10 years later, things were somewhat different, but I still hadn't had any conversation with anyone like me ever before. So I send this book out into the world. And eventually somebody that I was dating said that he looked me up and did I know there were people talking about me online? And I said, no, I had no idea. So he forwarded me where there were a group of other devs who were reading it as a book club book. And talking about how familiar what I had written was. Someone said it was like reading her own diary. Someone said she brought it to her therapist to explain, like, this is what I've been trying to tell you. Mm. So that was just incredible. And it feels so good to connect with other people and say, wow, I'm really not alone feeling like a total freak.
Could you find, like, evidence that this particular interest that like people like you have always existed? Like, do you find evidence in literature and history or have you even looked like to see? I mean, because obviously the internet helps people find each other and obviously all identities have always existed. I feel like there's nothing really new under the sun, but like, were you as a kid able to find stuff that just like, oh, I get it. Was there like literature, movies, etc., that really resonated with you, like throughout your life, or that you've come across?
Well, there was a lot of media that I really enjoyed, but it was not created with my enjoyment in mind.
Okay,
I didn't find anything like that. Like, I would say now
examples of that. Like, what did you come across, and you're like, tangentially, I'm going to be super into this, even if that wasn't your game plan.
Yeah, I always joke that my version of porn doesn't look like anyone else's porn. It can masquerade because nobody's going to realize that, like, you know, like the movie Avatar, super, super, super hot.
Oh, okay. Explain that.
The Jake Sully character.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's macho, he's badass, he's paraplegic. Not only is he paraplegic, they have him in a real wheelchair, which is incredibly rare in Hollywood. You'll usually see what I call the hospital chair, which is huge and clunky and like ill-fitted. And it's the kind of thing that you'd only use temporarily, maybe to go from the hospital entrance to your room. It's not a real wheelchair that people with permanent disabilities would ever actually use.
Uh-huh.
So they actually got a real chair that is sleek and sexy and moves well and fits him well. Plus, they had this character who's actually active and able to do things. So everything about that was fantastic until the end where, you know, he turns into a blue person.
like that cat bitch, get away from my man.
But, you know, when she finds him and he's like, he can't reach the oxygen mask and she holds the oxygen mask to his face and you see her as the blue person and him as a human being together for the first time. That's so romantic. That was a beautiful moment.
So you said that like that your porn would look different than other people's porn, but like clearly there is porn that has disabled people in it.
I have no interest in that really. I don't care about watching other people having sex.
All right.
The thing that turns me on is really these little moments of disability, watching someone move, watching someone transfer from a wheelchair to a bed, just those kind of things, which is why there's a funny effect that you'll see on YouTube, because some people with disabilities will create YouTube videos to help other people with disabilities learn how to do certain tasks. And you'll see like millions of views on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because the devs are watching it as porn. Which is kind of unfortunate because the poor person making this instructional video didn't intend to turn themselves into that.
Into a porn star.
Exactly. But, yeah, it's kind of unavoidable because we find those everyday movements so sexy.
So, like, there are not actually very many characters in general with disability in film. And, like, the ones that I can think of are, you know, like, often there's a lot of conflict around the disability. Very rarely is it just, like, a person who's just going about their lives. And they're, like, exactly. A normal person. Like, there's, like, Lieutenant Dan, you know, and there's, like, the drama.
Right. He has so much angst about it. And that's the central thing about his character. And the other sad thing with Lieutenant Dan is when he's in total crisis mode, he's using a wheelchair. But once he's got his life figured out, he's walking.
Yeah.
It's like you have to be upright and on legs in order to have your shit together. I don't understand that message at all.
But did you enjoy the shirtless Gary Sinise situation?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Because there's at least that. There's at least that.
There's some sexy great shirtlessness.
Yeah.
And I feel kind of guilty for supporting also the way that Hollywood doesn't cast disabled actors in these roles.
Yeah.
That they CGI able-bodied people who really have no idea what the experience of that disability is.
Well, in that particular one, I'm going to give them a... I'm not gonna give Forrest Gump a total pass as a film, but I will give that a pass because at some point he has to be able to like walk because he starts out being able to walk.
Yeah, so that is true.
I mean, it's not quite like casting a cisgendered person as a trans person. It's a little bit like, well, we need you to be cisgendered for most of it and then be trans later. So then that's like a different thing. But
yeah,
but I mean,
there's
totally
a lot
valid
of times
point.
When they
yeah.
could have done it and they don't. And I also always look now at Orange is the New Black for that example that you gave.
Yeah.
You know, they have Laverne Cox's character. They need to have flashbacks of when she was a man. They use the actress's twin brother.
Which is so brilliant that worked out.
And I'm
out.
Like, if you can find a trans woman who has a twin brother, then you can definitely find a disabled person with a sibling. You know,
yes.
Like you could do this. You're just not trying hard enough.
Yeah, I'm thinking of so many examples. Like, there's not a lot of examples of people with disability, represented in film in general, but the ones that I can think of are certainly not people who are, the actors do not share that disability. And like, there are some characters where, again, it's not like a major, dramatic element for them. They just are people. Like, the one that comes to mind is Macaulay Culkin in Saved, which I just love that movie in general. And he just, yeah, he's like super cool dude, like not super angsty about his disability. If anything, like his sister has a big issue with it. And like, that's more part of her character. Yeah. But I love that Macaulay Culkin
character because he is well developed and it comes up occasionally, but like, it doesn't derail his whole life. It's just part of it. I do like that portrayal a lot.
So in your fiction, what are some of your, talk about some of your books.
So, really, I've never been able to get over Hole and the characters from that. Like, they really lived with me for so long, and I created my absolute ideal perfect man in the hero Stuart. So I can't do better than Stuart, really.
Okay.
And I've written a sequel to it as well. There's Breathe, just continuing Elizabeth's journey. But yeah, I think Stuart is kind of the ultimate in sexiness. He's a former surfer. He's kind of a bad boy, but he's really sweet and caring. But like he holds himself together, and he doesn't reveal a lot. He's very in control of his life. And then I wrote, the most recent thing I wrote was The Billionaire's Secretary, because I wanted to give my own spin on this sort of popular category that's happening now with billionaire stuff. Uh-huh. That character is quadriplegic, and so it's more challenging to write, because you really have to learn, like, how do people with a higher level of injury go about accomplishing day-to-day things? You have to know about the technology that they can use and the things they have access to.
So how do you do your research?
Well, luckily for me, I've met many of these people. So that helps a lot, because when I first started, you know, writing Stuart back as a teenager, I knew no one with a disability. I was too scared to talk to them. They're probably thinking, oh, here's another able-bodied person who's just freaking out around me, and it's for a completely different reason than most people that I'm really attracted to them. But
I definitely empathize with you right there. Like, I'm super comfortable with talking to a lot of people, and if they're hot, I'm like, ah, just gonna flail around for a while and just like make weird noises.
Exactly.
I get you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but then I had the ability to actually start dating people and meeting a variety of people, and it helped me kind of mature the way that I thought about it, because it was no longer just my fantasy of what is a person with a disability like. It was, here are the real people and their varieties of experiences and ways of approaching it, and the realization that there isn't a one size fits all, that everybody approaches dealing with those physical challenges really differently. And that gave me kind of a freedom to express different kinds of characters.
So you mentioned earlier that you would go onto dating sites and people would be like, why are you here? Is that unusual? Like, and what sort of sites were you going onto? Like, what are some sites that you would suggest for folks who are either disabled or are interested in dating people with a disability?
Well, I was mostly on datingfordisabled.com, which is a free site, which, is plagued with a lot of the problems that free sites have. It's kind of a mess, and it's hard to sort through all of the noise to get to a genuine conversation, but it's one of the biggest ones out there. I think there's a lot of devs on there who are hiding what they are. I think that they'll say that they have a disability. I'm suspicious of anyone on there who says, my disability is a learning disability, you know, something like that. To me, that suggests that they're trying to come up with an excuse for why they're there, but they're really there because they want to date people with disabilities.
Interesting. Okay. Have you ever been approached by or talked to anybody on any of these sites that, like, doesn't have, like, a clear physical disability?
The first date I ever went on from this site was somebody that refused to show me a profile picture. And of course, being more savvy internet daters now, I'm sure, we would know that that's a big red flag. But of course, he made it sound like me wanting to see a picture of him is so shallow, and how could I be like that? He described his disability very vaguely. Some sort of like mobility trouble or something. And so I show up for the date and the guy is really ugly and no disability whatsoever in sight. He walked, you know, I was waiting for him at this cafe and I watched him walk from like five blocks away without any hint of mobility trouble. And he sits me down in this cafe and he just starts grilling me about sex and all this really uncomfortable stuff that was like, I was here to be romanced on a first date, you know? And then as we're leaving, he says, I have a wheelchair back at my apartment. You want to go see it?
Oh, he's like a pretender or something?
I suspect so now. I didn't have any idea at the time, but now I think he must have been. I don't know what other reason he would have.
Oh, interesting. I wonder, like, so yeah, I mean, that's a thing. You know, I've learned a little bit about, I can't speak to authoritatively. Do you feel comfortable discussing like the differences, like, and the folks who are like pretenders and the folks who, are aspirationally disabled, like those sort of things?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of empathy for that. It's not something that I have myself, but as I've met more people and learned more about it, I've come to really understand where they're coming from. I can put myself in that mindset and see what they're seeing. Whereas I've discovered that a lot of my friends who are not in this world are just like horrified. Like, how could you want to damage your body? I think that again goes back to society's image of what a disabled person is, to think that it's that horrifying.
So, could you just explain, like, for somebody who might not be familiar with these concepts, like, what are some of these folks thinking and feeling and wanting?
The people who have been called pretenders are people who will actually pretend to have a disability, either in private or they may try to go out in public and imitate a disability. There's also wannabes is another term that gets used for something similar. And, they're not very nice terms really.
Seems like none of the terms around this are very nice.
Yeah. We did not choose any of this, but you know, there used to be a website called transabled.org. And there's been some controversy now about exactly what the word transabled means or should mean, but I think it makes a lot of sense because it really is the exact parallel of transgender, that you have that really strong sense that your body is not what it was supposed to be, and you're going through depression and anxiety and having an incredibly hard time navigating having your body be different in the world than what your brain is telling you it is. And people that I've spoken to have expressed feeling an immense amount of relief when they are able to maybe not achieve exactly the disability that they see themselves with, but, you know, start using a wheelchair and doing stuff like that. It just, it relieves a lot of that tension for them.
And is that, you sort of alluded to the fact that it's like kind of controversial. Like, is there some pushback about this idea? Are people who are trans like finding this to be challenging?
I don't think that most transgender people are aware of this, as okay. I don't think most of society is aware a disability fetish at all. But I think there is a lot of pushback from people with disabilities. I saw an interview with a pretender woman that I know, and there was a journalist who's paraplegic and was very interested in getting a real conversation with her. So they had an interview and he was really respectful. He thought, you know, there's nothing bad about this. Like, it's like if I had blonde hair and you dye your hair blonde, like that doesn't affect me, that doesn't offend me. But the comments on the article were just horrible. There's just a lot of people who are like, I hate my disability and how dare you want it? Like, you have no idea what you're talking about. You don't know what this is like. It was so bad. She was pretty much driven off of social media completely. Huh. And I haven't heard from her in probably 2 years.
Wow. Okay. So I want to ask about your life now. All right. So you were on all these dating sites, and my understanding is that are you any longer on dating sites?
No, I am married, and I've been married 2 years. And it surprised everyone, including me, that I married somebody not disabled.
Oh, my. Okay.
I really thought, you know, I started out thinking my fetish is a bad thing. I must destroy it. Therefore, I will ignore it and date able-bodied people. I did that for a while. It was very unsatisfying. I was really miserable. So then I thought, I really need this in my life. I'm switching over to dating only people with disabilities. So I did that for a long time. And then I had this conversation with my cousin who has a disability. He was diagnosed, I think he was about 18, with a progressive neurological disorder. And so my interest in disability was already very formed by that time. He's a lot younger than me. So it was a little bit awkward to be like, oh, you know, Ruth has always been interested in disability, and now suddenly I have this person close to me who has a disability. But we talked about it a lot, and I like to think that I had a positive effect on how he has viewed disability, and that I helped him to come to terms with that. But he also helped me a lot, because when he got married, he said, my wife really doesn't care. It doesn't matter to her either way. She loves me, whether that's me with a mobility problem or not. And I was really inspired by that. I thought, I'm being too rigid about this. I need to be open-minded about who I'm dating and who I see potential with. So I met my husband, and he was just a really, really sweet, generous guy. And he knew, before he even met me, he knew the moment that he met me that I was a devotee. He had been told by a mutual friend of ours. So it was right up front. I didn't have to break this news to him. We were able to talk about it. We were able to talk about how to work it into our lives together. And I found that after having spent so many years dating people in real life with disabilities, that I was really able to put it back into the fantasy realm. Like, okay, I've experienced this, and now I can just enjoy it in my fantasy life.
So do you feel like sharing with us what that looks like?
Yeah, I guess. Some of my friends call it the highlight reel, where you close your eyes and you think about all the sexiest scenes you can, you know?
Okay. So are you working it into like role play, or is there anything like?
We haven't done role play because that feels super awkward to me. Okay. Like, my husband has offered, but it just weirds me out. I don't want to do it.
Okay.
It's something about, I think, again, going back to like non-disabled people playing the role of a disabled person. It doesn't feel right. Now, for someone who is transabled, that's a whole other story. But for somebody who's not and is completely able-bodied, to fake it, for me, it's just way too awkward. I don't like that. So
so when you say that you go into your highlight reel and you're like thinking about past stuff or whatever, like, are you not like present and like really like experiencing the stuff that is happening in real life in front of you, on you?
I would say that for the beginning of sex, we're very connected and in the present moment, and for the majority of it, we're connected to each other. But then when it comes down to that, like, okay, we are now going to climax, we both go to our own separate little things that get us off.
Okay. Do you know what his is?
I do.
Okay.
And I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, man. Man, it was really,
because, you know, I've chosen to be upfront about my quote unquote secret, which is really not a secret anymore. But everybody has their things, as I'm sure you have experienced and noticed in talking to people, that like we all have our weird little things. And so, you know, he has his, and that's his private business.
Okay, all right.
But we talk about it a lot to make sure that we're not feeling jealous or resentful or moving apart in any way. We spend a lot of time talking and sharing, and he shares with me whenever he finds any videos of disabled people or movies that are having a disabled character. Like, he'll always send it to me.
It's like,
stuff like that.
Like when people share like cat videos on my wall. I thought of you. Yes. Might be relevant to your interests.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who post those sort of things on my wall, and yeah, it's great. A lot of my friends know my interests, so they'll find stuff for me, and they'll ask my opinion about, like, is this exploitative? Is this quote-unquote inspiration porn? And it leads to a great conversation to be able to bring issues of disability and disability identity into a mainstream society.
How does it feel to be, like, sort of the spokesperson for this experience?
It wasn't what I set out to do. I just, I'm not a very private person. And I spent so many years just being secretive about this. You know, all through growing up and into college, I told no one. And it was a huge burden on me. And when I finally started talking about it to a few close friends, being able to release that just felt so good that I started talking about it with everyone. And I thought, let's just end the stigma about this. And I found it works very well for me. Some people have said that they've experienced negativity, but I've had very little of that. Mostly my friends have been like, oh, okay, you know, there's a lid for every pot. And they've been very accepting.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there are other people with their own perspectives and experiences of deafness, and I think sometimes some of them think I hog the spotlight a little bit. But a lot of people are afraid to come forward and put their name or their face to this. They're afraid of repercussions with their family, with their jobs, perhaps. So I end up being usually the only one who's willing to actually talk about it. So it seems, anyway.
Well, I'm sure people are interested to hear more about your books and stuff. So where can people find them? Where can they find more about you? That sort of stuff. Where should we send them?
I have a website, ruthmadison.com. My books are also at Amazon. They are available either as ebooks or as physical books that you can order there. Yeah, if you look up Ruth Madison, you are sure to find me.
Oh, okay. Right. So how many books do you have available right now?
Let's see. There's my seminal work, Hole. There's the sequel, Breathe. There's a short story that's free that is about Stuart specifically, and it does reference the other books and fall into a chronological order with them, but you don't have to have read the books to read that story, so that can give readers a kind of an idea of my style and the kind of characters I'm writing about. And then I have two collections of short stories called Dev Dreams. And then I have The Billionaire Secretary. Right. And I think that's all. Pretty sure that's all.
That's pretty good for someone who just like randomly was like, there's not enough books for people like me. I'm going to go write a bunch of them. That's awesome.
Oh, I have like full rough draft manuscripts of four more books, but it's become harder to get work done because now that some people know who I am and I have a name for myself, there's a lot of pressure, and it's, I'm always afraid that I'm going to let people down. So I'm afraid to release stuff.
This is kind of like also reminding me of Orange is the New Black. And when Crazy Eyes has like the erotica that everybody in the prison is clamoring for. And it's like, I am like made captive by my fame and like
I'm not exactly famous like that. I would love that, but yeah, that's a familiar experience of like, oh god, the pressure, so many people want something specific from me, and maybe it's all in my head, I don't know, but it's
No, I mean, especially if you're filling a niche that does not otherwise get filled, like, yeah, that is a lot of pressure. That's definitely a real thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's more books coming out now, which makes me happy. There's, I can't remember the name of it now. I think her name was Molly Mirren, something like that. She wrote a book from where the female character is a devotee. That's really rare. I mean, even in books that are written for us, it's usually like coincidental, you know, this able-bodied character meets a sexy disabled person and they have a romance. But there's just a few books that are like, yes, this is a person with a fetish and the person they're attracted to. And so I am no longer the only one doing that writing. There is somebody else. My friend wrote, I believe it's called Unconventional. And she got that published with like a real publisher. And that's a romance with a disabled hero. So we're making progress.
We're getting there. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. Like, I definitely feel like this is a viewpoint that I haven't gotten to hear about before. So I'm really grateful for you sharing your experience.
Awesome. I'm very glad to talk about it and let the world know that we exist.
Yeah. So thank you so much to Ruth Madison, author. You can go check out all of her books on the interwebs. And thank you everyone for listening and have a fantastic day. Hey, friends and family of Sex with Timory. We are so grateful to have your listenership. We have the coolest fans in the world. It's pretty much the best. And we hope that the love is mutual. If you are interested in supporting the Sex with Timory media, either the website, the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/sexwithtimory and become a supporter. For as little as $1 a month, you can be a regular supporter and continue to bring independent media that provides the kind of information that you want to have out in the world. Over here at Sex with Timory, we have been doing this stuff for years. As you've noticed, we've got over 200 episodes. The Sex with Timory website has been up since 2008. We've been giving you the goods for absolutely no cost, and we will continue to do so as long as we can. So thank you so much for your listenership, and we do hope that you will check it out. Patreon.com/sexwithtimory. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.